Hello, everyone. This is Bill Von Nahar with another edition of Moments in History. History Magazine, August-September 2019, has an article about the Four Georges. David Norris looks at the reigning monarchs of the Georgian era, the Four Georges. Great Britain never had a King George until 1714. But from that year until 1830, did the nation's monarchs bear any other name but George? The Four Georges would come to symbolize Great Britain so much that we refer to their reigns as the Georgian era. But the first George was hardly British at all. He came to the throne through a long chain of coincidence, political upheaval, and complex family relationships. In 1714, the last reigning monarch of the House of Stuart died. There were no direct heirs because Queen Anne had outlived all 14 of her children. By law, only a Protestant monarch could reign in London, but every one of Queen Anne's dozens of nearest relatives were Catholic royals or aristocrats in Europe. One had to run 57 spaces down the order of succession and travel across the sea to northern Germany to find a Protestant heir. Number 57 was George Louis. In German, he was George Ludwig, Elector of Hanover. His title of Elector meant that he was one of the Council of Royals who elected new Holy Roman emperors. Germany at the time was divided into numerous independent countries, ranging from large kingdoms to scores of tiny principalities. Born in 1660, George Louis was married to his cousin Sophia Dorothea, an illegitimate daughter of his father's elder brother. The marriage, arranged for financial reasons, was desperately unhappy. George Louis ignored his wife in favor of a mistress, and Sophia Dorothea had a scandalous affair with a Swedish nobleman, Count Philip Christopher. In 1694, Christopher disappeared. Many people then and later believed that George Louis hired some 17th-century hitman to kill the count. After her lover was vanished, Sophia Dorothea was imprisoned by her husband in a manor house. She lived in some style, but was kept under house arrest until her death in 1726. George I. In 1701, George Louis's mother, the Electress Sophia, was informed that she was the closest Protestant heir to Queen Anne. Sophia died shortly before Queen Anne, and the claim fell to the Electress' son. Accepting the offer of the British throne, George Louis was crowned King George I at Westminster Abbey in 1714. His English, then, was so poor that his coronation was conducted in Latin so he could follow the ceremonies. Shy by nature, the king appeared cold and awkward in public. His command of English improved, but he was never comfortable with the language or the people of his country. Much of the British public believed that he cared more for his German dominions than for Britain. Just after he was crowned, the new king faced a challenge to his authority when a Jacobite uprising broke out in Scotland in 1715. The last Stuart king, James II, was deposed in 1688 and died in exile in 1701. His claims to the throne went to the eldest son, James Francis Edward Stuart, known as the Old Pretender. Jacobus was the Latin equivalent of James, and those loyal to the Stuart claims became known as Jacobites. The 15 was soon put down, and the Hanoverian succession to the throne was saved. Although most Britons were glad that the monarch was secure, George I was never really popular. English, which he spoke with a marked German accent and some difficulty, was his third language. He was fluent in French. He disliked lavish and formal court ceremonies, so avoided many opportunities for his subjects to see him. His limited English and his dislike for public appearances made him seem more cold and aloof than he really was. Much of the public distrusted his ties to his native Hanover, where he often visited. court and parliamentary politics seethed with factionalism and intrigue, so the German king put great trust in German advisers. Even his mistresses were German, whom were granted English titles. The king's eldest son, George Augustus, was born in Hanover in 1683. He served in the 1701 to 1713 War of the Spanish Succession. Discord between father and son arose because the son resented the imprisonment of his mother, Sophia Dorothea. George I had been so angry at his wife that all of her portraits were removed, and the king's bitterness extended to his son and later to his daughter-in-law. Matters exploded in 1717 when the prince and his wife were banned from George I's court, and they lost custody of their children to the king. George Augustus's London home, Leicester House, became the center of dissident Whigs, opponents of his father's government. This family rift set a precedent that lasted for a century. George II and George III would both also have bitter quarrels with their heirs. George II. After the death of his father, Prince George Augustus became King of Great Britain in 1727. George II spoke English better than his father, but never shook his German accent. He was usually brusque and rude to courtiers and anyone else he had to deal with. Like his father, he preferred to spend his time in his German domains rather than in Britain, a fact that was much resented by his British subjects. Back in 1705, he had married Princess Caroline of Brandenburg-Anspach. As queen, Caroline's tact and charm did much to compensate for her husband's unpleasant demeanor. Behind the scenes, the queen had considerable influence with her husband and his ministers. She encouraged religious tolerance as well as smallpox vaccination. George II's popularity rose after he accompanied British and German troops fighting against the French at the 1743 Battle of Dittingen in Germany during the War of the Austrian Succession. On the battlefield, his horse panicked and bolted. A young officer caught the reins of the fleeting horse. Then the king dismounted and stayed on foot for the rest of the battle. Soldiers heard him say in his heavily accented English, "Now if my horse would run away, my legs will not." George II became on that day the last reigning British monarch to personally lead troops on the battlefield. George II's heir, his eldest son, Frederick Louis, was born in Hanover in 1707. He is remembered in several place names in North America, including Fredericksburg, Virginia. When George I took the throne, young Frederick was left behind to be raised in Germany while his parents moved to London. The prince did not relocate to Britain until he was grown, and the long separation permanently scarred his relationship with his parents. Frederick was at odds with his father when he died in 1751, leaving as heir his 12-year-old son, Prince George. George III. Young Prince George inherited the throne upon the death of his grandfather, George II, in 1760. His wife, Charlotte of Mecklenburg-Strelitz, was from a small German state, but George III was the first of the Hanover kings who was born in England, and the first who spoke English as his first language. At his coronation, George III was the last king of Great Britain to also be officially declared King of France, a holdover from England's French possessions that were lost back in the Middle Ages. A jewel became loose and fell from the crown during the ceremony. Years later, there were those who remembered that moment, seeing it in hindsight as an omen that this king would be one to lose his American colonies. In 1761, the king purchased a mansion called Buckingham House. It was bought for Queen Charlotte, and so became known as the Queen's House. The pair were so comfortable there that they made it their home and used it as their official 16th century St. James Palace only when they were obligated to for formal occasions. Greatly enlarged and now called Buckingham Palace, Queen Charlotte's home stands today as the most famous residence of the royal family. The king and queen led a quiet domestic life that their subjects regarded with kindly amusement. Both of them loved music. The king was a skilled harps player and also enjoyed drawing and painting. George III so enjoyed agriculture, he was particularly interested in raising pigs, that he was called Farmer George. When their children were young, the king was sometimes seen sitting or crawling on the palace carpets, playing with them. Although George III preferred a staid and respectable life, he was surrounded by scandal. His brother Henry died of syphilis. George's sister Caroline Matilda, who married the King of Denmark, was arrested for adultery. Queen Caroline Matilda was imprisoned in Denmark. Diplomatic negotiations for her release broke down. George III ordered a Royal Navy fleet to Denmark to rescue his sister, but the Danes relented before the British warships arrived. She spent her last years in exile at a Hanover castle until she died in 1773. 13 of George and Charlotte's 15 children survived to adulthood. Several of them would bring great public embarrassment to the crown. Two sons made secret and illegal marriages. Daughter Sophia had an illegitimate child from an affair with a royal equerry. George III's reign saw great changes in Great Britain and the world. Unfortunately for all his kindness and good nature at home, in politics and statecraft he was heavy-handed and hard-headed. He regarded stirrings of rebellion in the Atlantic colonies as personal insults to himself and the nation, and he encouraged his ministers who pushed for harsh policies against the colonies. It would be during his reign that the British Empire lost the 13 colonies in the 1775 to 1783 American Revolution. For a time, George III considered abdication, but by the end of his life, territorial gains in India and the founding of British colonies in Australia laid the foundation of a larger British empire. Mental illness plagued the last decades of the king's life. During the first flare-up in 1788, he raved so violently that his worried family and court officials put him through a harsh regimen. He was bound with ropes and a straitjacket and fed harsh purgatives. His doctors hoped that the rough treatment would scare him back into sanity. For a time, it seemed to work. After a few months, the king returned to his normal routine. In 1801, the king again suffered a breakdown and would be afflicted with some degree of mental illness for the rest of his life. In 1811, the king's condition deteriorated to the point that his eldest son, George, the Prince of Wales, was made regent. When George III died in 1820, he was the nation's longest reigning monarch until Queen Victoria. Both of these long reigns have been surpassed by that of Elizabeth II. Of all the children of George III and Charlotte, it was the most scandalous of all who succeeded to the throne. Prince George had secretly married an actress, Maria Fitzherbert, in 1785. The pair kept their marriage under wraps, but the prince's long affair with Mrs. Fitzherbert was general knowledge. Crushed by massive debts from gambling and his extravagant lifestyle, the prince was persuaded to make a respectable marriage in return for Parliament paying his obligations. George IV. In 1795, the Prince of Wales married a cousin, Princess Caroline of Brunswick. Few royal couples were more ill-matched. Not regarded as attractive, Caroline was also loud and crude in contrast with the genteel manners expected in court circles. The prince so hated the sight of her that they spent only a few days together. The royal couple separated, and Caroline carried on affairs, as did her husband. Rumors abounded that she had given birth to a son after an affair with a footman. Caroline went to live in Europe, and after 1814 had an affair with King Jacobin of Naples, a brother-in-law of Napoleon. The only bright spot in their marriage was their daughter, Princess Charlotte Augusta. She was popular with the public, who were relieved to have a pleasant young princess to reign after her mad grandfather and her selfish and shallow father. She was deeply mourned by the nation after she died at the age of 21 in 1817. Desperate for a divorce, when George IV was weeks into his reign, he induced Parliament to put his wife on trial. The House of Lords eventually condemned her for acts highly unbecoming to her rank and station and of a most licentious nature. Queen Caroline was more popular with the public than her husband thought. As the House of Commons were more afraid of London mobs than the king, they refused to convict the queen, and the divorce was not granted. After turning down £50,000 to stay in Europe, Queen Caroline was not invited to her husband's coronation at Westminster Abbey. Just the same, she arrived in a six-horse carriage and demanded entrance. A doorman asked for her ticket, and she replied that she, as Queen of England, needed none. Pages and soldiers, aided by several prize fighters hired by the new king as security guards, blocked her way. Then every door to the abbey was shut and locked. Guests inside were trapped for hours in the stifling heat of a July day. Despite the embarrassing spectacle, or perhaps because of it, she ordered the top of her carriage lowered as she was driven away in full view of the crowds outside the abbey. Caroline died shortly thereafter. Public sympathy for her made her husband even less appealing to his subjects. Despite the weight he steadily gained from his overindulgence in food and drink, George IV was vain about his appearance. He applied leeches to his face to keep a pale complexion. Desperate to fit in the fancy military uniforms or trendy clothes, he wore tightly stretched stays under his jackets to hold in his stomach. It was George IV's misfortune to live in an era where sharply satirical cartoon prints were popular and abundant. During the regency and his kingship, caricatures depicted him as a fat fop, obsessed with trendy and expensive clothing. In an era where poverty was rife and much of the time at war with France, the cartoons made him even less popular. By the time of his death in 1830, many Britons were starting to believe that the monarchy did not have a long future. No legitimate heirs were left by the dying king, so the throne went to the next surviving son of George III, William, Duke of Clarence, a longtime naval officer, and he was crowned as William IV in 1830. He reigned until his death in 1837. The sailor king, William IV, also let no legitimate heirs of his own. However, his brother Edward, the Duke of Kent, had fathered a daughter shortly before his death in 1820. And so it was that on June 30, 1837, the Archbishop of Canterbury and the Lord Chamberlain of the House rode to Kensington Palace and awakened a 19-year-old Princess Victoria. The niece of George IV and William IV was now the Queen of Great Britain. The accession of Queen Victoria marked the end of the Georgian era, and it also broke ties linking Great Britain with Hanover. By law, Hanover barred women from the throne. The closest male relative after William IV, his brother the Duke of Cumberland, was to reign in Hanover as King Ernest Augustus. Hanover was to have only one more king. George V of Hanover, son of Ernest Augustus, was deposed when Prussia annexed Hanover in 1866. shortly prior to the unification of Germany. Great Britain would have two more Georges on the throne. George V, who reigned from 1910 to 1936, and George VI, 1937-1952. Father and son, that pair built much more goodwill than did the first four Georges. Today, Elizabeth II's great-grandson, Prince George of Cambridge, born in 2013, eldest son of Prince William and his wife Catherine, Duchess of Cambridge, is third in the line of succession to the British throne. That's the end of the story from David Norris, who tells us about the four Georges. He looks at the reigning monarchs of the Georgian era. That was written by David Norris. That was in History Magazine, August-September 2019. We have another shorter article in this same magazine, and it's entitled Philately. Philately? It's written by Jeffrey Orens. Over 150 years ago, in 1864, the word philately was devised by a French stamp collector named George Herpin as his version of an attractive term for a relatively new hobby of stamp collecting. He concocted the word by grafting the Greek root word for loving, phil, with the Greek noun elatedly, which meant tax-exempt or tax-free. He formally proposed the word philately that year in an article for a French stamp collecting magazine, generating a groundswell of support. The word was promptly anglicized the next year to philately, but how does philately, literally translated as love of tax exemption, how does that equate to stamp collecting? In 1840, the British established the first mail delivery system that used stamps. Previously dating back to 1635, the postal service was available to the general public in England. Any mail delivered was paid for by the recipient, but this wasn't always efficient if the receiver of the mail refused to pay. The new idea was that the charge to deliver a piece of mail was to be prepaid by the sender, and the word free was stamped on the mail, indicating to the recipient that they did not need to pay for it. Adhesive stamps were quickly introduced, and the sender affixed these to the mail instead. Either way, recipients of mail were now receiving these letters free of charge, or tax-free, if one considered that the cost of the stamp was a tax on mail delivery that the recipient no longer paid. When stamps were first introduced, some immediately began to collect them. The words first used to identify stamp collecting were timbrophily or timbromania. They were a combination of the French timbre, which meant a stamp, and the Greek suffix philly, again meaning one who loves or has a mania for excessive enthusiasm, thus creating words for a stamp collector or stamp enthusiast. These were more definitive terms, to be sure, but many thought them rather cumbersome. Though technically accurate for describing stamp collecting, Herpin expressed the feelings of the times that these designations were spoken of with a touch of sarcasm or condescension. He wanted to create a new expression that provided what he felt was an appropriate level of dignity and freshness for the relatively new hobby of stamp collecting. In his view, philately was a term that conveyed that spirit, and other collectors apparently agreed with him. Over the next decades, the new prepaid stamp system became ubiquitous for mail delivery across Europe and the United States, eventually covering the world. So did Herpin's nomenclature, which was generally well-received and increasingly employed as time passed on. Each country created its own stamps of differing denominations and unique designs, with colorful representations of people, places, activities, and themes. The growth of philately mushroomed on a worldwide basis, and this love of tax exemption was enshrined as a term of endearment, if not a less unwieldy term for stamp collecting, as well as the broader study of other more technical aspects of stamp production and identification, including stamp design, perforation, and markings such as overprints and security marks. That was the article Filatedly, and that was written by Jeffrey Orens. That's also in the History Magazine, August-September 2019. We just have a couple more minutes, and we're going to do some historical trivia. These questions are first rejected and now collected. I'm going to read a question, give you a minute or two to think about the answer, and then come back and provide the answer, and you can tell me if you got it right. First one, this book, Tom Clancy's first book, was turned down by more than two dozen publishers before it became a huge bestseller. This book, Tom Clancy's, was turned down by more than two dozen publishers before it became a huge bestseller. What was the name of that book? Who's got the answer to that? All right, while you're talking about that, while you're thinking about that, let's move on to the next one. This Southerner's first novel, turned down by 28 publishers, was called A Time to Kill. His next book was a bestseller. Who's the author? This Southerner's first novel, turned down by 28 publishers, was called A Time to Kill. And his next book was a bestseller. Who is that author? But going back to that first question, and I'm sure you have the answer for it already. This book, Tom Clancy's first book, was turned down by more than two dozen publishers before it became a huge bestseller. Okay, what was it? Speak it out loud. Yes, I think I hear someone saying it. It was The Hunt for Red October. That's right, The Hunt for Red October. Moving on to the second question. Who's got this one right? This Southerner's first novel, turned down by 28 publishers, was called A Time to Kill. His next book was a bestseller. Who is the author? And the author is, wait, John Grisham. That's right, John Grisham. And I think that's all we have time for today, and we appreciate you listening. And until next time, please come back and listen to Moments in History by Bill Vondehar. Thank you.